added to it. Coincidence? Perhaps. But I don't recognize coincidence. I think we serve a God of coincidences. Not that he manufactures coincidences, but it certainly looks that way when he's finished. Anyway, we're open for questions and comments on any of the portion up to now. If you have a mic and you'd like to get on, just raise your hand. I'll be happy to give you the mic. And if you don't, go ahead and type it into the text. We'll see if we can get any questions answered. Certainly give it a shot. Drop the computer. Yeah, exactly. Eddie's still in Israel. I did not know that. Thank you for the information, Jeremiah. So he will have his update will be on at 2 o'clock. Are there questions or comments? Nothing? No questions or comments? Okay, well then we'll start with verse 1, and we'll work our way through, we'll do 46 through 54. And Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh, and went throughout all the land of Egypt, and in the 7 plenteous years, the earth brought forth by hand, gathered up all the food of the 7 years which were in the land of Egypt, and laid up the store in the cities, and the food of the field, which was round about every city, laid he up in the same. And Joseph gathered corn, as the sand of the sea, very much, until he left numbering, for it was without number. And unto Joseph were born 2 sons before the years of famine came. Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bare unto him. And Joseph called the name of the firstborn Menasseh, for Yahweh, said he, or Elohim, said he, hath made me forget all my toil and all my father's house. And the name of the second called he Ephraim, for Elohim hath caused me to be fruitful in the land of my affliction. And the 7 years of plenteousness that was in the land of Egypt were ended, and the 7 years of dearth began to come, according as Joseph had said. And the dearth was in all lands, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread. And when all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried to Pharaoh for bread. And Pharaoh said unto all the Egyptians, Go unto Joseph, what he saith unto you, do. I'm going to stop there, and we'll start there again in a few minutes. Okay. Jono and I were talking about this last week as we spoke of Asenath. Okay, a listener commented on Asenath and brought the following info to my attention. In Egyptian, her name means belonging to Nath, or Nath. Nath being the Egyptian goddess Isis. She was called Nath at first, and then in the later years became known as Isis. Or the Ephesians Diana, or Babylon's Ishtar. They're all the same goddess. But in Hebrew, it means under a thorn bush. It's proposed by the rabbis, according to the Jewish Encyclopedia, that she is actually the daughter of Dinah by Shechem's rape in chapter 34. The brothers didn't want this reminder of their sister's defiling, so Yaakov placed Asenath under a thorn bush, a blackberry bush, to be specific, from whence an angel picked her up and took her to Egypt and Potiphar, the eunuch, and his wife, to raise in anticipation of Joseph. Another rabbinic idea is that she was taken to Egypt and left at the outer wall of the city, where Potiphar heard her crying and went out to investigate the noise. When he saw the baby, he took her in to raise as his own. either way. This is also a convenient explanation of a seeming contradiction in chapter 46, where Torah says that Yaakov came down to Egypt with 70 of his descendants, but only 66 are listed as making the journey. Adding Yosef and his sons brings the total to only 69. But if Asenath is Dinah's daughter, and it solves two problems for us and for the rabbis. Number one, the 70th descendant of Israel is already in the land with Yosef. And two, Yosef doesn't marry an Egyptian woman, but his own niece. And Ephraim and Manasseh are not half Egyptian and half Israelite. If Asenath was not a descendant of Israel, she's the only non-Israelite mentioned in chapter 46, and that's in verse 20. If Asenath knew her real ancestry was Hebrew, this would also give credence to the idea that it was she who told the true story to Potiphar that kept Yosef's head in place and gave Potiphar the ability to keep Yosef where he could help him prosper and be promoted. Potiphar was Lord High Executioner, remember, and was therefore in charge of the prison system. So Yosef's character and servant's heart would still bring Potiphar profit. Yosef starts putting his plan to save Egypt and his own family into effect, and the storehouses are filled until they are ready to burst. So an entire city is built for storing the grain, and I think that city's name was called Sukkot. Interesting, eh? When Israel leaves Egypt, they journey to Sukkot to get Yosef's bones before they take it on the land. And that's, by the way, in Exodus chapter 13, verses 19 and 20. During the 7 years of plenty, Yosef's sons are born, Manasseh and Ephraim. It is interesting that Yosef was fruitful as the land was fruitful. But when the drought came, he stopped having children. The drought was general, not just in Egypt, but Egypt was prepared for it, while everyone else just kept on living as usual. When Yehovah sends judgment on his people, he brings them time. He rather gives them time to prepare, as he gave Yosef in Egypt. When we're here in 2007, if Rip played this that last week, you got some of my stuff back then. But when we were here in 2007, I made the statement that America was near the end of our years of plenty, and the dearth was about to begin. Funny thing happened. In Sukkot time of 2008, just 9 months later, the housing bubble burst in America, taking the world's economy into a nosedive. Now, this is a big if. It's in italics. It's bolded. It's underlined. This is a big if, okay? If that signaled the beginning of the 7 years of Yaakov's trouble, sometime around Pesach of 2012, we can expect the anti-Messiah to be revealed. And sometime around Yom Kippur, Sukkot, of 2015, Messiah to set foot on the Mount of Olives. If what I said was true, and the tribulation began with the stock market, or with the housing bubble, and which caused the worldwide depression, or rather recession, if that was it, then we can expect to see these things happen. So keep your eyes open. And if you see somebody walk up onto the Temple Mount, and first of all, if you see the temple being built, which can be done in a very short time, if you see that temple being built in Jerusalem, then you know that we're probably in the last few years. If you see the Anti-Messiah set himself up as God in that temple, then we know that we're at the halfway point. Okay, so those are the things that we need to watch out for. Okay, this coincides, by the way, Messiah putting his foot on the Mount of Olives on the full moon in September, October of 2015. Coincides with the blood moons that are happening in 2014 and 2015 around Pesach and around Yom Kippur, The blood moon would be on the 15th, which would be the first of Sukkot. And by the way, also solar eclipses that happen at the same time, you know, and in those same months, in the first month and in the seventh month of both 2014 and 2015. Just saying, these things, the coincidences are happening. And I'm telling you, we serve a God of coincidences, okay? It's not that they're coincidences, they're His plan. It's all planned out. It just looks like a coincidence to us. Okay, now, if you want to read about those blood moons, by the way, around the feasts of Yahweh in the first and seventh months of 2015, there's an article at WorldNet Daily that quotes Mark Biltz of El Shaddai Ministries. I like Mark Biltz a lot, by the way. I disagree with him on a few minor points, but they're minor points. This is a good teacher. Anyway, it's at www.wnd.com, WorldNet Daily, wnd.com/?, page ID. The I in page ID is the only capital letter there, equals 63076. I'm going to give that to you again, and Rip, if you can put it in the text, it would be good. www.worldnetdaily, wnd.com/?, page, capital I, small d, equals 63076. Need it again? I'll give it to you again. Okay, here it is. www.wnd.com/?, P-A-G-E, capital I, D, equal 63076. There you go. And we're exactly. Okay, now we're over for questions and comments. Up to verse 55. Servant 60, you may have the mic. Take it away.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Just give me a moment. Oh, thank you very much. Mark, if you count the souls that went to Egypt during the time when Judah told his father Jacob that Joseph lives. There were 69 souls. But then, I'm going ahead a little bit. But then, in Genesis 46, verse 26, says, all the souls that came to Jacob into Egypt, which came out of his loins, besides Jacob's sons, wives, and souls, were 60. Makes 70. I believe, now I don't know if this is true, I'm not sure, but I think the 70th soul was Moses' mother, Yochebed, and she was born in Egypt the same day they arrived in Egypt, from what I understand. I could be wrong, but I don't know. I leave the mic to you.
Okay, there we go. Yes, that was one of the things that the rabbis talked about. Absolutely. But they also talk about Asenat. In the Chumash, they brought it up, and in a number of things that I looked up on the web. I looked up Asenat on the web, and I looked in Jewish encyclopedia, and that's one of the things that they gave as well. Some people do say that Yochebed, I think that was what her name is, Moses' mother was born immediately after they got to Egypt. That she was carried in the womb. But you know what? There were no women listed among them except for Asenath. It could be either way. If we look at our passage in Acts today, if we keep reading through there, we'll see that Stephen says that there are 75 souls that went in there, quoting quoting the LXX. What is that? Septuagint. So, yeah. Yeah, he says that there are 75 souls went in there. And, so we've got all these difficulties with this thing. But the deal is that 79 souls included, first of all, Yosef and Menashe and Ephraim. There were only 66 that actually went with Joseph into the land. Okay, there were already three there, adding up to 69. And then there's one missing. There were only 69 named. And so we had the fact is that if Asenath was the offspring of Shechem and Dinah, and she was taken to Egypt before in preparation for Yosef, then that makes sense again. The only daughter that may have been named would be Dinah, I think, and I'm not even sure about that. Eve's Garden. I might be wrong. I haven't looked that up recently. We can go there and have a look. We can actually name them all if you'd like, because I like rabbit trails. Okay, 46. Okay, somebody get out your hands and count these as we go. And these are, this is in verse 8, and these are the names of the children of Israel, which came into Egypt, Jacob and his sons. First of all, it's Jacob and his sons, all that are named. Reuben, Jacob's firstborn, and the sons of Reuben, Hanoch, Phallu, Hezron, and Carmi. And the sons of Simeon, Yemuel, Yamin, and Ohad, Yakin, and Zohar, and Shaul, the son of a Canaanitish woman. And the sons of Levi, Gershon, Kohat, Merari, we're at 15 already. And the sons of Yehuda, and Onan, and Shelah, and Perez, and Zerah. But and Onan died in the land of Canaan, so we can go back to, what would that be, 19 now? Anyway. And the sons of Perez were Hezron and Hamul. And the sons of Issachar, Tola, and Fuva, and Yov, and Shimron. And the sons of Zebulun, Zerad, and Elon, and Yalail. These are the sons of Leah, which she bare unto Jacob in Padan Aram, and his daughter Dinah. All the souls of his sons and daughters were 33. That's by Leah. And the sons of Gad, Ziphion, and Hagi, and Shuni, and Ezbon, Eri, and Arodi, and Areli. And the sons of Asher, Yimna, and Ishua, and Isui, and Berea, and Sirah, their sister. And the sons of Berea, Heber, and Malchiel. These are the sons of Zilpah, whom Laban gave to Leah his daughter, and these she bare unto Yaakov, even 16 souls. So we got 16 and 33 is 49. The sons of Rachel, Yaakov's wife, Yosef and Benjamin. And unto Yosef in the land of Egypt were born Menashe and Ephraim, which Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bare unto him. And the sons of Benjamin were Bilhah, and Becher, and Eshbel, and Gera, and Naaman, and Ehi, and Rosh, and Mupim, and Hupim, and Ard. Wow! He had a lot of kids. These are the sons of Rachel, which were born to Yaakov. All souls were 14. That brings us to, 63? And the sons of Dan, Hushim, and the sons of Naphtali, Yazeel, and Guni, and Yezer, and Shelem. These are the sons of Bilhah, which Laban gave to Rachel, his daughter, and she bare these unto Jacob. All the sons were 7. And all the souls that came with Yaakov into Egypt, which came out of his loins, besides Yaakov's sons' wives, all the souls were 66. And the sons of Yosef, which were born in Egypt, were 2 souls. All the souls of the house of Yaakov, which came to Egypt, were 70. Now, wait a minute. Just said 66 came with him. There were three already there, but it adds up to 70? Okay? So it's a good possibility that Asenath was named because she was a daughter of Judah. I'm sorry, a daughter of Dinah, and therefore a descendant of Yaakov. I'm just saying it's a good possibility that that's what happened. Other questions or comments? If you'd like to take the mic, I'll give it up freely. Nobody else wants to raise their hand? You guys are really going to be bored listening to me all day. Not only that, we're going to finish pretty quick, too. Okay, we're going to start in verse 55, and we're going to go through 42:17. Let me get back to chapter 41 and verse 55. And when all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried to Pharaoh for bread. And Pharaoh said unto all the Egyptians, Go unto Joseph, what he saith to you, do. And the famine was over all the face of the earth. And Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold unto the Egyptians. And the famine waxed sore in the land of Egypt, and all countries came into Egypt to Joseph for to buy corn, because of the famine was so sore in all lands. On to chapter 42. Now when Joseph saw that there was corn, when Yaakov saw that there was corn in Egypt, Yaakov said to his sons, Why do you look one upon another? And he said, Behold, that's a kind of a cocky way of talking, isn't it? Anyway, what are you looking at each other for? Behold, I have heard that there is corn in Egypt. Get you down thither, and buy for us from thence, that we may live and not die. And Joseph's 10 brothers went down to buy corn in Egypt. But Benjamin, Joseph's brother, Yaakov sent not with his brethren, for he said, Lest peradventure mischief befall him. And the sons of Israel came to buy corn among those that came, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. And Joseph was the governor over the land, and he it was that sold to all the people of the land, and Joseph's brethren came and bowed themselves before him with their faces to the ground. And Joseph saw his brethren, and he knew them, but made himself strange unto them, and spake roughly unto them. And he said unto them, Whence come you? And they said, From the land of Canaan to buy food. And Joseph knew his brethren, but they knew him not. They knew not him. And Joseph remembered the dreams which he dreamed of them, and said unto them, Ye are spies, to see the nakedness of the land are ye come. And they said unto him, Nay, my lord, but to buy food are thy servants come. We are all one man's sons. We are true men. Thy servants are no spies. And he said unto them, Nay, but to see the nakedness of the land are ye come. And they said, Thy servants are 12 brethren, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. And behold, the youngest is this day with our father, and one is not. And Joseph said unto them, That is it that I spake unto you, saying, Ye are spies. Hereby ye shall be proved. By the life of Pharaoh, ye shall not go forth hence, except your youngest brother, come hither. Send one of you, and let him fetch your brother, and ye shall be kept in prison, that your words may be proved, whether there be any truth in you, or else by the life of Pharaoh, surely ye are spies. And he put them all together in ward 3 days. Okay, it's the end of our Torah portion. Notice that when the Egyptian people started to get hungry, they cried out to Pharaoh, who sloughed it off on Joseph. He had come to realize, as the jailer had, that he could take an extended vacation if he wanted to, because Joseph was there. 3 weeks in the Bahamas? Why not? Joseph has my back. So, Joseph fed the people, but not for free. I suspect the Egyptians got their own back cheaper than foreigners did, but that isn't certain. It is certain that Egypt owned all the land of its enemies very soon after the drought began. I think that was Paro's plan from the minute he heard Yosef speak of preparation for the calamity that was about to hit. It wasn't but 3 to 4 years before Paro owned the whole nation of Egypt. And he was able to say it was Yosef who stole all their money and property. Nice guy, huh? Not. Having all the food in the known world, Paro was able to gather in all its wealth to be in preparation for Israel's exodus 8 to 9 years after, before his arrival. 8 to 9 years before Israel's arrival, Pharaoh was gathering together all the wealth of the world so that Egypt could, so that Israel could plunder Egypt on their way out. And we'll see that in Exodus chapter 12, 13. Okay, chapter 42. It has now been 22 to 23 years since Yehuda sold Yosef into Egypt. Yosef's brothers don't recognize him. He was a youth then. He was a youth when he left, and now he is viceroy of Pharaoh, but he knows them. They bow their faces to the ground in fulfillment of the dream in verse 37. They are obviously nervous and know that this guy can do nasty things to their bodies if he desires, and they start doing what most folks do when in the presence of authority and uncertain of their position. They experience diarrhea of the mouth. It's very hard in the situation they were in not to just keep giving up more information than the authority wants and to talk their way into trouble. When authority asks for information, give them what they need and nothing more. An answer of, I don't know, when you don't know, really will suffice. An answer of yes or no will suffice most of the time. The more you blabber, the more he'll have to use against you. Be respectful and succinct. If they make unfounded accusations, as Yosef is doing to his bros, make a denial and then shut up. The pressure is coming from two directions on Yo's bros, though. They need food, so they are trying to appease this guy the best they can. So Yosef makes his demands known. 9 of you stay behind, and 1 go and bring your brother. My brother, my mother's son, he doesn't say. And you can trade freely with us. Show me your brother, as you claimed, and I'll know that you're true men. So for 3 days he puts them in jail. He'd been in for 2+ years. When he brought them out after 3 days, does that sound familiar? Coming out of jail after 3 days, coming out of exile in 3 days, coming up from the earth in 3 days, he'd have more to say to them in 3 days. We're open for questions and comments. Anybody got anything? I'll be happy to give up the mic. Questions or comments? My lovely bride just arrived. She came in here and was... Okay, Eve's Garden, you may have the mic.
I'll try, but I think I'll probably lose it shortly after I start. One interesting thing about this portion is that not he also saves the largest number of people of the earth. Breaking up? If it's... Sorry, I may just not be able to transmit. So he also saves all the other people that are in existence. So if you think about it as compared to Israel in the diaspora today, not only will the house of Israel be reunited and rejoined, but a great multitude will be saved, that they too will come out with Israel, I believe. The great multitude is being foreshadowed here in this story of Joseph. And then something very interesting that I saw, I think it's next week's portion, so I'll just mention it though. When Joseph sold the grain to the people of Egypt, they traded all their herds, their cattle, etc., and then they came and sold their lands, and then I think they became servants. So when it fast forward all the way to the Exodus, that it said that the servants, those people who were slaves in Israel, came out. Technically, right now, at this point here, in our next point, all of Egypt, Egyptian priests become slaves to Pharaoh, went out with Israel in the future to be much greater than I ever expected. I just thought that those other left were a small population, but all of Egypt becomes slaves to Pharaoh, a small population. So consequently, descendants of these slaves that are about to become to this famine, were they slaves at the group? That's really not all saying that Jacob's is that is because we're going to see in our next portion where Joseph acknowledges to his brothers that it was God indeed who sent him down there. Now, if God sent him down there, God chose him because he knew he was going to reveal it to us. We don't necessarily know himself higher than his brothers, but we do know that the brothers responded in a wicked way. And so if it was God chose, and they acknowledged that it's God's plan who did it. So it would be us to call God wrong for choosing Joseph, who may have revealed those dreams in humility. And I release the mic.
Yeah, it was breaking up quite a bit. I don't understand why that is, but it was kind of hard to make out. Patty by Grace, if you'd like to take the mic, feel free.
Oh, sure. Give me the mic while I still have a bagel in my mouth. Excuse me. All right. Somebody just brought up something. Jeremiah brought up the thing that Joseph was 30 and Yeshua was 30. Then some people said that the Bible doesn't say that Yeshua was 30. Okay, well, is it only... you can't start your ministry until age 30? Yeah, I know, it was up. Wouldn't that apply to Yeshua? But then again, I had to ask myself, well, do we know that he started immediately at age 30? It's a question I thought should be brought up. Was Jesus 30 years old? Or Yeshua, I'm sorry. Excuse me. When he started his ministry? And did that correlate with Joseph being 30 at the same time? Means we're looking for types and stuff here. I just thought that was something curious, and I was wondering if that's true or not. Was Yeshua 30 when he started his ministry? Go ahead. He could have been as old as 39? Anyway, it's just a question I had because I've never really thought about it.
Okay. Yeah, the conventional wisdom is that he was 30 years old when he began his ministry. First of all, anyone who was being trained in the Pharisee tradition, to be a rabbi, he had to wait until he had to have the Torah, the five books of Moses, memorized by the time he was 20 years old, and then he could begin his training. And he had to have the oral traditions memorized by the time he was 30 to get to start his ministry. And generally speaking, the Pharisees, the rabbis, released their Talmudim to go out and teach to become rabbis of their own, in their own right at the age of 30. So that's a possibility. It was different for the priesthood, but it was for as far as the Pharisees, the rabbis were concerned. That's my understanding anyway. Is that way, Servant 60? You may have the mic back.
Can you hear me now? This one. Okay. In Luke chapter 3, verse 23, it says, "And Yeshua himself began to be about 30 years of age, being, in parentheses, as was supposed, the son of Joseph, which he was the son of Heli." And it goes on and go on, who's the son of this, who's the son of that, and not that. So he was about approximately 30 years old. I release the mic.
Thank you, Serve 60. Appreciate that. I knew that was in there somewhere, but I couldn't remember where it was, and I haven't had time to actually look it up. So, what verse was that? Can you put that in the text, please? Servant 60. Luke 3:23. Began to be about 30 years old. You know what's interesting? The Jews don't, the Hebrews don't count years the way we do. Okay, we have a child born, and that's his first day, and the next day is the second day, and he ages by one day at a time. In Hebraic thought, that child is born and he begins his first year, and when he comes to his birthday again, he begins his second year. Okay. Now, I understand it's kind of crazy, but and that's really a better way to reason that thing. The kid's in his first year. When you have when it says that you're going to have a yearling or a first year lamb to have for the Pesach lamb, that's what they're talking about. A lamb that has not been walking around on the earth for over a year. Okay, so if Pesach is, say, in our reckoning, April 15th, okay, you can't use a lamb that was born anytime before April 16th, the year before. Okay, do you understand that? Because that's a lamb of the first year. Because on April 16th, he begins his second year. And he's the lamb of the second year now. And that's how they work that. So when it says that he began to be about 30 years old, it means that he has lived all of 29 years, and the 30th, that day could very well have been his 30th, what we would call his 29th birthday. But he began his 30th year on that day. See? Yeah, it gets confusing trying to put a different reckoning in your mind to try to see what the scripture says, but it's important because it's anyway. Are there other questions or comments? Is there anything in the text that I missed? I don't think so. Okay, if there are no other questions or comments, I'll go on to the Haftarah portion, which is Isaiah chapter 11. And we're going to read the whole chapter. Let's see, there's 11. And here's Yeshayahu. Where are you? There you are. "And there shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. And the spirit of Jehovah shall rest upon him, the spirit of wisdom and understanding, the spirit of counsel and might, the spirit of knowledge and of the fear of Jehovah, and shall make him of quick understanding in the fear of Jehovah. And he shall not judge after the sight of his eyes, neither reprove after the hearing of his ears. But with righteousness shall he judge the poor, and reprove with equity for the meek of the earth. And he shall smite the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips shall he slay the wicked. Wow, who is this describing? And righteousness shall be the girdle of his loins, and faithfulness the girdle of his reins. The wolf also shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the kid, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. And the cow and the bear shall feed, their young ones shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like an ox. And the sucking child shall play on the hole of the asp, and the weaned child shall put his hand on the cockatrice's den. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of Yahweh, as the earth waters cover the sea. And that's as far as we're going to go. We see here the seven spirits of Elohim are delineated in verse 2. They are referred to in Revelation, John to the seven churches which are in Asia, grace unto you and peace unto him which is and which was and which is to come, and from the seven spirits which are before his throne, in Revelation chapter 1 and verse 4. Then in chapter 3 and verse 1, it says this, and unto the angel of the church of Sardis write, these things saith he that hath the seven spirits of Elohim and the seven stars. I know thy works, for thou hast a name that thou livest and art dead. Then in chapter 4 and verse 5 it says, and out of the throne proceeded lightnings and thunderings and voices. And there were seven lamps of fire burning before the throne, which are the seven spirits of Elohim. And then in chapter 5 and verse 6 it says, and I beheld, and lo, in the midst of the throne and of the four beasts, and in the midst of the elders stood a lamb as it had been slain, having seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of Elohim sent forth unto all the earth. Now, we just came through Hanukkah, and I was watching a DVD from First Fruits of Zion. Boaz Michael was on with Mark something or other. I can't remember what his last name is. And they were talking about Hanukkah, and they were talking about the menorah in the Holy of Holies, on the Holy Place, rather. And they spoke of the lights being referenced by the rabbis as the eyes of Yehovah. And so that's interesting. So we have the menorah is a picture of the seven eyes of Yehovah. It's a picture of the seven spirits of Yehovah. So let's see what we got. Here's what I have on that. The menorah in the Kadosh place represents the seven spirits of Yehovah, as is illustrated in Revelation 4:5. If you reference the tree of Sephirot, which, by the way, hang on a minute and I'll get you... oh, darn. I'll get you a website where you can go and look at it. And it is... Where are you? Zohar, Tree of Sephirot. And the web address is zion.org/tree_Sephirot, Sephiroth.htm. And I'm going to put that away. Okay. If you look, reference the tree of Sephiroth, you'll see all of these spirits of El Shaddai. The next three verses illustrate how the spirits of Elohim work in and through us. The spirit of understanding, if you're looking at that tree of Sephiroth that I was telling you about, you'll see that on the right-hand side of the page, or whatever, is Ima. Okay, and that is the Ruach HaKodesh in the reference. The Ima works in those of us who fear Yehovah And that understanding will help us to not judge by our fleshly senses, but by his Spirit. The Spirit of knowledge, and if you look on the left-hand side of the page there, you'll see that the Father is knowledge of... pretty sure that's right, isn't it? I'm sorry, no, that's wisdom. That's right, he's the wisdom. And knowledge is in the Son. Okay. I've lost my place. Here we go. Knowledge with wisdom equals understanding. And knowledge with understanding equals wisdom. Knowledge alone makes one haughty. And 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 1, Rav Shaul writes, "Knowledge puffeth up, but charity edifieth." The spirit of counsel is the mercy of Elohim, while the spirit of might, I'm referring to Isaiah chapter 11 here, it equals his severity. So if you're looking at that tree of Sephiroth, right in the middle of the of both sides, you'll see the severity and the mercy of Elohim. Okay, the man in the middle has his hands on both sides, and the mercy and severity together create what we see as beauty in the center. Getting back there. Okay, so the spirit of counsel is the mercy of Elohim, and the spirit of might is his severity. Paul speaks of the goodness and severity of Elohim in Romans chapter 11 and verse 22 in his discourse on Yisrael, and the grafting in of both Ephraim and Yehuda. His merciful wisdom has let Ephraim come back to him, while his severity has exiled those who know his truth but do not understand it. They can be grafted back in, as was Ephraim, but their knowledge is puffing them up. They need to temper their knowledge with wisdom and understanding of all the Tanakh has to say to them. That's, by the way, Israel, the rabbis as we know them now. As we exercise in the seven spirits of Yehovah, we prepare ourselves for our places as viceroys in his kingdom and beyond into eternity. That's pretty much what I've got on Isaiah. Are there any questions or comments? Oh, Servant 60, you have your hand up. Please take the mic now.
Concerning the spiritual gifts, in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, says, "Now concerning spiritual gifts, brethren, I would not have you be ignorant. You know that you were Gentiles, carried away unto these dumb idols, even as you were led. Wherefore I give you understand that no man speaks by the Spirit of God called Yeshua a curse, that no man can say Yeshua is the Lord but by the Holy Ghost. Now there are diversities of the gifts, but the same Spirit. And there are differences of administration, but the same Lord. And there are diversities of the operation, which is the same God which worketh in all. But the manifestation of the Spirit is given to every man to profit withal. For to one is given the spirit of the word of wisdom, to another the word of knowledge by the same Spirit, to another faith by the same Spirit, to another gifts of healing by the same Spirit, to another workings of miracles, to another prophecies, to another concerning the spirits and diverse kinds of tongues, and others interpretation of the tongues. May all these work of one and self same Spirit." Anyway, I just wanted to reveal that I think goes along with Isaiah. I release the mic.
Well, I think you're probably right. I'm sure that that Rav Shaul had a working understanding of Isaiah chapter 11, and he probably had that in his mind while he was formulating that whole midrash. By the way, almost everything that Paul wrote was midrash. Okay, he was taking things from this area of the scripture and that area of the scripture that were seemingly unrelated and jamming them together and making a point. That's what Midrash is. And that's basically what Shaul was doing. All in everything that he wrote, almost everything that he wrote, and in everything that he taught, he was trying to make sure that people understood the Torah the best that they could. And that was his thing. That's why I think that he wrote the book of Hebrews, because that thing is nothing but Midrash from beginning to end. And so, okay, are there other questions or comments out there? No questions or comments, eh? Okay, well, I guess we'll move on to the psalm then. Yes, most everything that Paul wrote about was from Torah. Absolutely the truth. And he, like I said, he midrashed his way through that thing. I mean, his whole reason for existence, I think, was to midrash. Let's see, Psalm 35. That's where I want to go. I'm trying to find the. Okay, Psalm 35, and beginning in verse. We'll just read the whole thing. Beginning of verse 1. Plead my cause, O Yehovah, with them that strive with me. Fight against them that fight against me. Take hold of shield and buckler, and stand up for mine help. Draw out also the spear, and stop the way against them that persecute me. Say unto my soul, I am thy salvation. Let them be confounded and put to shame that seek after my soul. Let them be turned back and brought to confusion that devise my hurt. Let them be as a chaff before the wind, and let the angel of Jehovah chase them. Let them let their way be dark and slippery, and let the angel of Jehovah persecute them. For without cause they have hid for me their net in a pit, which without cause they have digged for my soul. Let destruction come upon him as at unawares, and let his net that he hath hid catch himself, and into that very destruction let him fall. And my soul shall be joyful in Jehovah, it shall rejoice in his salvation. All my bones shall say, Jehovah, who is like unto thee, which deliverest the power of the poor from him that is too strong for him, yea, the poor and the needy from him that spoileth him? False witnesses did rise up. They laid to my charge things that I knew not. They rewarded me evil for good, to the spoiling of my soul. But as for me, when they were sick, my clothing was sackcloth. I humbled my soul with fasting, and my prayer returned into mine own bosom. I behaved myself as though he had been my friend or brother. I bowed down heavily, as one that mourneth for his brother. But in mine adversity they rejoiced, and gathered themselves together. Yea, the abjects gathered themselves together against me, and I knew it not. They did tear me, but and ceased not. With hypocritical mockers and feasts they gnashed upon me with their teeth. Lord, how long wilt thou look on? Rescue my soul from their destructions, my darling from the lions. I will give thee thanks in the great congregation. I will praise thee among much people. Let not them that are mine enemies wrongfully rejoice over me, neither let them wink with the eye that hate me without a cause. For they speak not peace, but they devise deceitful matters against them that are quiet in the land. Yea, they opened their mouth wide against me, and said, Aha! Aha! Our eye hath seen it. This thou hast seen, O Jehovah. Keep not silence, O Lord. Be not far from me, I believe where it says Lord in else says Adonai. Stir up thyself and awake to thy to my judgment, even unto my cause, my Elohim and my Adonai. Judge me, Yehovah, my Elohim, according to thy righteousness, and let them not rejoice over me. Let them not say in their hearts, ah, so would we have it. Let them not say, we have swallowed him up. Let them be ashamed and brought to confusion together that rejoice at mine hurt. Let them be clothed with shame and dishonor that magnify themselves against me. Let them shout for joy and be glad that favor my righteous cause. Yea, let them say continually, let Yehovah be magnified, with which hath pleasure in the prosperity of his servant. And my tongue shall speak of thy righteousness and of thy praise all the day long. Yehovah was Yosef's buckler, shield, and fortress while in Egypt, and his trust in Yehovah delivered him through hardship and exile to his position of viceroy and the fulfillment of the dreams he'd had in chapter 37. As Yosef was raised up in the day and a mere servant in Potiphar's jail to a vice-regent of the most powerful nation on the earth, he understood that all that had happened to him over the last 13 years was meant for the good of the world, as well as Israel's little band of Hebrews. He saw that it was what Yehovah had planned, and that he could not see until he got there. His mouthing off to his elder brothers, his sale to Egypt, Potiphar's wife's horniness, his time in Slam, and his gift of interpretation of dreams had all worked together for good to those who love Elohim and are called according to his purpose. He didn't even know when he spoke to his bros about their bowing down to him. But he was answering Yehovah's call. Neither, usually, do we when we do some of the stupidest stuff, like cutting down a big tree. But if we trust Yehovah to deliver us and leave it to him to do, we'll be amazed at what he'll do to protect us and to prosper our way. Psalm 35 is mostly imprecations, David calling his ways to mind, and then asking Yehovah to judge and punish those who work against Yah's plans and ways. Here are a few phrases just grabbed at random. Verse 3, stop against them that persecute me. 15, but in mine adversity they rejoiced and gathered themselves together. The abjects gathered themselves together against me, and I knew not. They did tear and ceased not. With hypocritical mockers in feasts, they gnashed upon me with their teeth. Yehovah, how long wilt thou look on? Rescue my soul from their destructions, my darling from the lions. In verse 5 and 6, let them be as chaff before the wind, and let the angel of Yehovah chase. Let their way be dark and slippery, and let the angel of Yehovah persecute them. You get that last thing there? Let them be as chaff before the wind, and let the angel of Yehovah chase. It's Yehovah's wind that's blowing that chaff away. And he's serious about this imprecations. He's calling down judgment on his enemies. It isn't pretty when we leave them to Yehovah and then ask his destruction to be on them. But sometimes it's necessary. When they keep sniping and trying to destroy you, you have little choice but to call Yehovah's wrath down on them. Now that is not to say that you can call down his wrath on your enemies. If you perceive someone as your enemy and they are not or have done nothing to deserve your animosity, and you call Yah's wrath down, that is a false witness. Remember what happens when a false witness is found out. Here is what our attitude is to be. Verse 13 and 14. But as for me, when they were sick, my clothing was sackcloth. I humbled my soul with fasting, and my prayer returned unto mine own bosom. I behaved myself as though my friend... I'm sorry, I must have screwed that up. Let me get it back out of the... I behaved myself as though he had been my friend or brother. Oh, I removed the italics. Sorry. As though my friend. I behaved myself as though he was my friend or my brother. I bowed down heavily as one that mourneth his mother. Okay, when my enemy was in affliction, I prayed for him. I went and saw what I could do to help him. Okay, that's supposed to be our attitude. Until they demonstrate that they want our destruction. Our imprecation should be with the hope of their repentance and reconciliation. And that's the point that Daniel or David's trying to make in verses 13 and 14 here. Okay, that's all the I've got on the psalm for today. Are there questions or comments from the Peanut Gallery? That's y'all, by the way, the Peanut Gallery. And I'm making myself old because I'm telling you that I know who Buffalo Bob Smith is. Questions or comments on the psalm? He's asking God, do you have my back? And he's praising Elohim that he does have his back. Absolutely. Okay. No questions or comments? If that's the case, we'll move on to... I'm caught. I can't believe this. See you later, Patty. Service is starting, eh? There we go. All right, then we'll move on to the Brit Hadashah portion, which is Acts chapter 7 and verses 1 through 19. Acts chapter 7. You know what? Let's... Oh, wait. Simchat Torah. You may have the mic.
Okay, I'll try again, but it may be the internet, not my computers. So, in this particular psalm that we just read, Mark, it seems to me that this would be the prayer of Joseph while he's in Egypt before he reunites with his brothers, that he's not talking about some abject enemy of the nations, but rather... it's descriptive of how he would have felt and what he might have prayed when his brothers were not reconciled with him. And so many of those verses are, because for instance, what David says is that hypocritical mockers in a feast, they gnashed upon me with their teeth. And there was another verse that I really liked. And it shows here that if you were putting Joseph as the one praying that, but as for me, like when you read that verse in verse 13, when they were sick, my clothing was sackcloth. I humbled myself with fasting and prayer, returned into my own bosom. And it tells how he loved them. That's why I think when I was on the mic before and it was breaking up, I feel that saying that Joseph was a loudmouth or... was haughty is a false accusation, much like what Esau would say towards Jacob, even though, I mean, he had those dreams. They were of God. And so who's to challenge that God chose an unrighteous, unworthy man to receive them? So here you have Joseph as a young man interacting with God, and he tells it, what was he supposed to have done, remain silent? And then if he had remained silent, we wouldn't have seen the fulfillment of God's plan, because he would not have had his brothers respond in a wicked manner. He wouldn't have been sent to Egypt, where he was promoted in positions to have elevated him to restore many people. And you hit upon it this time in this psalm, is that not only did Joseph save Israel, but he saved multitudes of people in the world, which I think will be also the case of Israel in the end of days. Their return to Torah and Messiah and their testimony to the world will be a witness of God that will cause many, a great multitude, to be saved, I think, just like what we saw Israel in Egypt. But I don't really buy into the fact that Joseph did anything wrong. Certainly if this psalm is indicative of his heart, it shows that even, and you know, I was thinking about it, even while he was in Egypt, everything he did had the hand of God with him. So if he acted in any way whatsoever that was in impropriety, God certainly blessed him. I had some other comments about Isaiah, but I won't go back there. I'm going to release the mic on this psalm. And then if you'll just let me know if this computer was working. Thank you.
It actually worked quite well. when you first came on, it bounced a little bit, but then it was very strong. Maybe it is the computer. It's a good possibility. You had using the same mic? Just at the very beginning, in the first sentence or two, it shut off, and then it came back on. It carried the whole message through. That was only on my computer. That could be my computer doing that. Okay, yeah, you might be a connection in the mic cable, too. So, always a possibility. Okay, are there other questions or comments on anything up to this point? All right, then we will move on to the Brit Hadashah. 19 verses in the 7th chapter of Acts, beginning in verse 1. Then said the high priest, are these things so? You know, let's move back into chapter 6. I believe that it begins in like 5 or 6 verses. That's 16. 6. I don't know why that does that. Okay, starting up in verse 9. Then there arose certain of the synagogue, which is called the synagogue of the Libertines, and Cyrenians, and Alexandrians, and of them of Cilicia and of Asia, disputing with Stephen. And they were not able to resist the wisdom and the spirit by which he spoke. Then they suborned men, which said, we have heard him speak blasphemous words against Moses and against God. And they... against Moses and against God. That's it. Okay. And they stirred up the people and the elders and the scribes and came unto him and caught him and brought him to the council and set up false witnesses, which said, this man ceaseth not to speak blasphemous words against this holy place and the law. For we have heard him say that this Jesus of Nazareth shall destroy this place and shall change the customs which Moses delivered us. And all that sat in the council, looking steadfastly on him, saw his face as it had been the face of an angel. Now I'm going to move back here for just a second. Verse 14, it says, for they have heard him say that this Jesus of Nazareth shall destroy this place and shall change the customs which Moses delivered us. Doesn't say the laws that Moses delivered from Mount Sinai, but the customs that Moses delivered us. And Yeshua was not going to change all of them, because some of them are probably still good for us to follow. However, those that they held to, you know, the fences that they built around the Torah so that we couldn't get to it, those definitely Yeshua wanted to tear down. And so they weren't bringing a false accusation on that. But here we are in chapter 7. Then said the high priest, Are these things so? And he said, Men, brethren, and fathers, hearken. The Elohim of glory appeared unto our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia, before he dwelt in Haran, and said unto him, Get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred, and come into the land which I shall show thee. Then came he out of the land of the Chaldeans, and went to Haran. And from thence, when his father was dead, he removed him into this land, wherein ye now dwell. And he gave him none inheritance in it, no, not so much as to set his foot on. Yet he promised that he would give it to him for possession, and to his seed after him, when as yet he had no child. And Elohim spake on this wise, that his seed should sojourn in a strange land, and that they should bring them into bondage, and entreat them evil 400 years. And the nation to whom they shall be in bondage will I judge, said Elohim. And after that shall they come forth and serve me in this place. And he gave him the covenant of circumcision, and so begot Isaac, and circumcised him on the eighth day. And Isaac begot Jacob, and Jacob the 12 patriarchs, and the patriarchs, moved with envy, sold Joseph into Egypt, but Elohim was with him, and delivered him out of all his afflictions, and gave him favor and wisdom in the sight of Paro, king of Egypt, and he made him governor over Egypt and all his house. Now there came a dearth over all the land of Egypt and Canaan, and a great affliction, and our fathers found no sustenance. But when Yaakov heard that there was corn in Egypt, he sent out our fathers first. And the second time, yes, and the second time, Joseph was made known to his brethren, and Joseph's kindred was made known unto Paro. Then sent Joseph, and called his father Yaakov to him, and all his kindred 75 souls. So Yaakov went down to Egypt, and died, he and our fathers. And they carried over unto Shechem, and laid in the sepulchre that Abraham bought for a sum of money of the sons of Amor, the father of Shechem. But when the time of the promise drew nigh, which Elohim had sworn to Abraham, the people grew and multiplied in Egypt, till another king rose which knew not Joseph. The same dealt subtly with our kindred, and evil entreated our fathers, so that they cast out their young children, to the end that they might not live. Okay. This is from our Midrash of about a month or so ago. Stephen was rehearsing the history of Israel, and he made a few mistakes in it. But that helps us to establish the bona fides of the account. The fact that Stephen made some mistakes in his recounting the history of Israel proves that Stephen was telling the story out of his head, and not Luke putting this thing together. Because if Luke had been putting it together, well, I will tell you here. If Luke was fabricating this story, he'd have made sure to cross all of his I's, all of his T's, and dot all of his I's. The fact that we witness a couple of mistakes, well, one actually, in Stephen's monologue tells me that Luke is telling the story as it happened. He's telling us exactly what Stephen said. He's not telling us what actually happened, okay? Mistake number one is that Jacob was buried in Shechem, when he was really buried in Hebron and Machpelah, on land that Abraham bought. Mistake two is that Stephen says that Abraham bought the land from Hamor, father of Shechem, when Yaakov bought that land. I think Stephen just got the land involved in his story wrong, a simple human mistake. The Ruach was not inspiring Stephen's memory, but Luke's account of what Stephen said. Okay? Or, Stephen was using Midrash to show that Yaakov's sons had conquered the Canaanites long before they entered the land to possess it, and that when he bought that property, it was a foreshadowing of Israel occupying Kol Haaretz, the whole land. as Yehovah had promised to Abraham. There is a remez or a hint here, by the way. When Stephan talks of Yosef revealing himself to his brethren the second time they came to Egypt, that's in verse 13 of our passage, it hints that Yosef, Ephraim, and 10 Israel, being revealed to his Yehudi brethren, to Israel, at Messiah's second coming, when he comes as Messiah ben David. Questions or comments? I don't believe that it is an error, Simchat Torah, of the inspiration of the scripture. I believe that it's an error that Stephen made, and it's just being recorded faithfully. Well, if Stephen didn't make the error, then that means that Luke, in his writing, made an error. Okay? See, Abraham did not buy the land from Hamor's father, from Hamor, the father of Shechem. He bought land from Machpelah, he bought the land in Mamre, in Machpelah, near Hebron, from the people in Hebron. I forget what the guy's name was. Okay? That's where Abraham bought land. And Yaakov wasn't buried in Shechem. Yaakov was buried in Hebron, in Machpelah. So someone made an error in this thing. And I don't believe that it was the Spirit that was making the error. I think it was the memory of Stephen. Either he made an error, or he was making a midrash, like I said. So it's one or the other. So there's either an error, or there's a midrash going on. No, the King James Version didn't make the error either. This is a faithful rendering of the Textus Receptus. They did not mistranslate this purposely. Okay, now the Textus Receptus may have an error in it. That's a possibility. So, somewhere, an error got into our thing here. So, but in the meanwhile, that just proves the bona fides of the inspiration, as far as I'm concerned. You know what? I don't know if the other 11 are still buried in Egypt. I would think, possibly. The only one that we have a record of being brought out is Yosef. But you know what? There's also a possibility that as they died, they were carried back to Machpelah, or back to the land, and buried on their own land in Israel. But it's, you know, it's all speculation. Who knows? We don't have the records of their deaths and of their burials. That's right, they were not slaves at that time. Yes, he bought it. There you go, from Ephron. That's correct, servant 60. And he bought it for 400 pieces of silver. And that's, by the way, the cave of the sepulcher of the patriarchs, and that's the place that Palestinians are saying is theirs, when we have a 3,500 year old contract recorded in the scripture. Okay, are there other questions or comments? Okay. Go ahead. Take the mic.
Shabbat shalom, everyone. Give me a one if I could be heard, please. I just found the missing piece to this. In Acts 7, verse 16, when it says they were carried back to Shechem, and they laid him in the sepulcher that Abraham bought for the sum of money for the hams of Hamor, the father of Shechem. When it's saying Abraham bought this for a sum of money, by Abraham, he's meaning the sons of Abraham. You see what I'm saying, fulfilling Torah? By this, he's meaning the descendants of Abraham. Genesis 33:19. Look at Genesis 33:19. He bought the tract of land where he had pitched his tents from the children of Hamor, Shechem's father. 100 pieces of silver. So Stephen is 100% correct. Because when he's saying Abraham bought this, he's meaning Abraham's descendants or Abraham's lineage. Genesis 33:19. Praise Yahweh. May Yahshua be glorified. Praise Yahweh through Yahshua Messiah. The scriptures are 100% correct. We just have to understand this. Okay, let me put this together. Let me get my eastward real quick. Acts 7:16 says Abraham bought this for the sum of money. We know that Abraham didn't buy this, as you just said, but Abraham's descendants bought it. Am I right? Am I correct on that? Abraham's descendants bought this for a sum of money from the sons of Hamor. That's what Genesis 33:19 says. Now I'm going to pass the mic and let you come and comment on this.
Okay. Let me go to a different part of the scripture and show you where this is not the right way to think. In Hebrews, we're told that Levi gave tithes to Melchizedek in Abraham because he was in the loins of Abraham. So Abraham gave tithes, and therefore his descendants gave tithes. But there isn't anywhere where it says that the descendants did something and it accrued to the father's thing. The father can pass that on, but the son can't pass it back to his father. I just do not see that. I don't see that at all. The scripture says Jacob bought that land from Shechem's father Hamor for 100 pieces of silver. It says that Abraham bought the land of Machpelah from Ephron for 400 pieces of silver. And I'm sorry, but and then it's this act says that Jacob was buried in Shechem when he wasn't. He was born in Hebron in Machpelah. Now Joseph was carried back, and I believe that Joseph was buried in Shechem, and we can look for that in Exodus somewhere. Oh no, I take it back. We probably would find that in Judges somewhere. Let me see. Maybe I can find that real quick. Like, where are you? Joseph. And we'll find him in Joshua. Yeah, let's see, Joseph, and we'll add the word buried. Joshua 24:32, and the bones of Joseph, which the children of Israel brought up out of Egypt, buried they in Shechem, in the parcel of ground which Jacob bought of the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, 400 pieces of silver. Okay, so that's all I'm saying is that Stephen mixed up either Jacob buying the parcel for Abraham buying the parcel, or that Jacob was buried in Shechem rather than Joseph. It was the mind of Stephen that had the problem. It was not the inspiration of the writer. There is no error in the scripture. There may be an error in the memory or the teaching of the guy who's being quoted. That's the way I see that anyway. Yes, Machpelah is where everyone was buried up to the time that Joseph was taken over and buried. He was buried at Shechem. Okay. Okay. Other questions or comments? No other questions or comments? Anybody got a hand up? No hands up. Okay. If there are no other questions or comments, then I would say that our Midrash for today is complete. We have, Simchat Torah, you have a question or a comment. Why don't you go ahead and take the mic?
Okay, I have a problem thinking that there's an error there, but nonetheless, it very clearly looks like an error, but it doesn't mean that it necessarily is. In Genesis 33:18, it's talking about Jacob came to Shalem, a city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, and when he came from and Danarim to pitch his tent. So that's, we've already seen Jacob. There's an interesting thing that happens. In Joshua 20, it says, they appoint, Joshua 27, let me put it for you. They appointed in Galilee and Naphtali and Shechem and Mount Ephraim and Kirjah Arba, which is Hebron and the mountain. So we can see that Shechem is Mount Ephraim, Hebron is the mountain of Judah. Something interesting then, in Joshua 1:24, this is right before Joshua's death, and it says, Joshua 1:24, 1, and Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel to Shechem. So this is after they crossed over and they've taken the land, and I believe they've pretty much conquered everybody, but I don't know that for certain because I didn't rush ahead to see what the rest of Joshua is. But they've taken the greatest part of the land, it looks like. So he calls all the tribes of Israel to Shechem, and he calls the elders of Israel and the heads and the judges and the officers and presented God. And Joshua said unto all the people, thus said the Lord God of Israel, your fathers dwelt on the other side of the flood in old time, even Terah, the father of Abraham, the father of Nahor, and they served other gods. And I took your father Abram the other side of the flood and led him throughout all the land of Canaan and multiplied his seed in Isaac. So it's going on about Joshua's doing of the Exodus. But in Joshua 24:25, it says here that so Joshua made a covenant with the people that day. and he set them up a statute. They're establishing themselves in Shechem. What if this I'm going to and put it forth. I'm going to pause at 7. Six, oh, well, let me release the mic and come back.
Okay, why don't you go ahead and take it back now?
Okay, I'll try again. I'm not certain what the source of the problem is. I think it's just, I mean, it says, now, let's back it up one more. So Jacob went down into Egypt and died, he and his fathers. So Jeremiah asked a good question. She said, what about the other fathers? What about the other brothers? Well, so we know the bones of Jacob, and they buried them. Hebron, that's for certain. So what if Acts 10 and 16 is saying, after Jacob died and they carried the bones, here we see in Joshua where they're setting up the statute in the Mount Ephraim, which is at Shechem. What if from after setting up that statute, they then took the bones and buried him in Hebron? And what if 6 foot the commas? Let me show you where if we punctuation, which wasn't there in the original. What? Let me show you. Let me put this here. What if I put an extra comma in? In verse 16 it says, and were carried into Shechem and lain in the sepulchre of Abraham, bought for a sum of money of the sons of Emor, the father of Shechem. What if we put a comma in there and it said, Joseph's bones were carried into Shechem, which we see where Joshua met, and that would be true, and laid in the sepulchre of Abraham, because from Shechem they took him to Hebron, and that bought with a sum of money of the sons of Emor, the father of Shechem, would be applying to Shechem, not Hebron. Maybe we're just reading it wrongly because punctuation was never there in the New Testament. So that would be, let me actually take that and, yeah, that's what I think is wrong. I think that the interpreters have left out, and watch this, or if it were tight, and whoever interpreted it clearly didn't know the story. Oh, let me type in.
Okay, you went away. you want to try to take it back again? I'll give you a couple of seconds to try to take that mic back. Okay, one comma making it appear to be an error. Where is the which comma is that? The one that follows what? Let me go back to Acts because I'm in Joshua now. Acts chapter 7. And you said it was in verse 16, which is where the error would be if there is one. And were carried over unto Shechem and laid in the sepulchre that Abraham bought for a sum of money from the sons of Emor, the father of Shechem. All right, well, they got Abraham in there is what the problem is. Okay. I mean, we can do a lot of what ifs. But what if doesn't cut it? I mean, what if a frog had a glass butt? Would he only hop once? You know. What if a frog? What if a mosquito had machine guns? You know, would frogs mess with him? And I'm sorry, but I don't have another version of the scriptures here with me today. Ari-Z, originally the tabernacle was put up in the land of Ephraim in Shiloh. And David brought it from Shiloh to Jerusalem. Let's see. Yes, Joshua made a covenant with the people that day and set them a statute and an ordinance in Shechem. And that's the verse immediately following, I think, where he buried Yosef in Shechem. Olki, I do not see that. You can make that assertion all you like, but unless you can show some kind of biblical reasoning behind it, Yaakov bought it, not Abraham. If Abraham had bought it, then you could make the assertion that Jacob did, because we have other testimony to that in Scripture. But I don't see anything like that anywhere else. Okay. Anyway, are there other questions or comments? If there are any more questions or comments, we'll give up the mic, or if you can. Then we're pretty much done here today. So I'll give the mic back over to Rip Van.